We have with us today Victor Davis Hanson, who, among other things, is a military historian and best-selling author. He's been a commentator on warfare and contemporary politics for many media outlets, including Fox News, The Washington Times, and National Review. Professor Hanson is also a professor emeritus of classics at California State University, Fresno, and a senior fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. And, of course, his book, The Case for Trump, is a New York Times bestseller. Victor, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start right in with this one. The Democrats appear to want to do everything they can to create new voters who are more favorable to their socialist policies, such as lowering the voting age to 16, allowing felons to vote, and even allowing undocumented immigrants to vote in local elections, which, as we all know, is just the first step toward their being allowed to vote in national elections as well. So I'd like to know where you think all this is going in the next 3 to 10 years. What do you think is the end game for Democrats and for America as well, for that matter?
Well, I think it's the realization of an agenda of which they don't have confidence in the present electorate or the present process of voting to achieve. So whether we talk about lowering the voting age to 16 or allowing ex-felons to vote or abolishing the Electoral College or packing the Supreme Court or having a virtual open border with 20 million illegal immigrants and who can already vote in some local elections, I think that the purpose of they're not happy with the Americans here and how they vote. And if they're ever going to get the Green New Deal or abortion as permissible, infanticide or reparations or wealth tax, 90% top rate on income tax, abolish ICE, abolish, you know, student debt, free tuition, Medicare for everybody, outlaw private insurance, they're just not going to be able to do it under the existing voter constituency and voting laws. So they have to alter both. They're not going to change their message or moderate it in a way or even engage people to win them over. They have no desire to do that.
What do you think is ultimately going to happen? Are they going to be able to do this, or is there going to be enough pushback to stop them?
It's hard to tell. I mean, this is an existential struggle where there doesn't seem to be much compromise. When you look at Antifa and, you know, what Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez says, or what Al Sharpton's doing this last week and mandating that the candidates accept reparations, I don't know how that's synonymous or compatible with a traditional Republican or conservative or central traditionalist agenda. They're not compatible. So one side's going to have to win and one side's going to have to lose, because I don't see anybody. There's no area to compromise that I can see. It reminds me of the 60s when it was guaranteed income for everybody and we're going to, disarm and all of that student stuff. And that more or less lost. The silent majority won. I mean, they had an enormous influence on the culture, but their visions for a left-wing socialist America kind of died with George McGovern.
Yeah, I remember that very well. And I agree with you totally. There really isn't any compromise. Kind of like Ayn Rand put it, how do you compromise between good and evil? And that's what I think it gets down to. The thing that worries me is that I hate to give Democrats or radical leftists credit for anything, but I think if there's one thing they do way, way better than Republicans, it's relentlessness. I mean, they never ever back off, and they're not shy about things where in the past the Romney McCain type of Republicans are always intimidated into giving in. Don't you see the radical left as being relentless, far more relentless than Republicans?
Yeah, I think that was the theme of the book that I wrote on The Case for Trump, that one of the conditions that created Trump was a broad conservative distaste for, I call them in the book, markets of Queensbury Republicans, that they felt it was better to lose nobly than to win kind of ugly. and the left had no such compunctions. And so when Candy Crowley in the second debate grabbed that microphone, we all wanted Romney to stand up and say, how dare you, instead of just sort of acquiesce. Or we couldn't believe that when we were out there fighting for John McCain, he sort of saw the limb that we were sitting on off when he said, now, we're not going to mention Reverend Wright in this campaign, who was a legitimate target as being the confidant and personal pastor of the soon-to-be president of the United States. So I agree, and that's one of the reasons that we got Donald Trump, because whatever he was, people felt that he was A, authentic. He didn't change his accent. He didn't change his clothing. He talked like he was in Queens, whether he was in Bakersfield, California, or Youngstown, Ohio, and he would fight. And he wouldn't, I guess in a political movement or party, the worst thing that can happen to the base is to get out in front of the candidate. In other words, they, in their zeal, they want to help the candidate, but when the candidate looks around and gets embarrassed of his own base and saws them off and says, how dare you, then the whole movement falls apart. Well, people haven't been able to do that with Trump. I mean, they feel whatever he is, he's going to be leading the pack. And that hasn't been true of Romney and McCain. And I think that I agree with you. There was a strong yearning for somebody to fight back. And the odds are against the conservatives, because while they have the numbers, I think the majority of Americans identify as conservative, they don't have the levers of cultural power. The universities, Hollywood,
yep,
the media, professional sports, entertainment, the foundations, they just don't have it. And that popular culture is very, very persuasive and influential.
Yeah, that's a subject I'd love to interview sometime for 2 hours and go into that and that alone in depth, because that's very interesting. But you made a really interesting point that I never heard it put that way before, that when the base gets out in front of the candidate, when I think of those horrible, horrible two elections we went through in 2008 and 2012, when I think of McCain, all I think about is his being quick to say, somebody was saying something about Obama he didn't like, and he said, he's a fine gentleman. And then you got Romney saying, he's a nice guy. And that's the Republican response. Victor, I got to tell you, I don't ever remember any Democrat talking like that about a Republican candidate.
Surely not Obama. Remember in 2008, he said to his supporters, I hear you Philadelphia people have a reputation as brawlers, so I want you to bring a gun to a knife fight. And then he said, I want you to get in your face. And then when he was president, it was punish our enemies, and you didn't build that. And yet, if you had been a Republican and said that, they were afraid. I guess the problem is that too many conservative or Republicans or whatever we call them are afraid that they'll be criticized as racist, homophobe, sexist, nationalist, isolationist, protectionist, whatever. And they'll do almost anything to avoid that label because they feel that it's so all-encompassing and it brings such disparagement and unpopularity that they're willing to make a compromise with the left. Please just don't call me that, and I'll modify my behavior accordingly.
Well, that's a whole psychological study all by itself. You know, while we're talking about illegals voting, let me put you on the spot and ask you, if you were president, what steps would you personally take to put an end to illegal immigration? I know mine are considered extreme, but I don't consider them that. But I'm really interested in hearing what you would do.
Well, I don't think I would get in these big fights like Trump is. I just would do what Obama did. Remember, he said 21 occasions that he didn't have the power to offer amnesty, and then he finally just did it, and through an executive order, and the courts have upheld it. So, what if I were Trump? I wouldn't talk about shutting down the government. I wouldn't talk about declaring an emergency. I would just call in the head of DOD, Homeland Security, EPA, Department of Interior, and I said, listen, you guys have multi-billion-dollar budgets. This section of the border is, I feel there's endangered species here. This section, there's cartels, there's endangered. This section, this is for national security. This section, I want to protect more of our fauna and flora, and just do it with existing budget money. The second thing I do is I just signed an executive order and said, we're getting $60 billion sent out of this country by people here, mostly illegally, and about half of them, a quarter to a half, are on some sort of public support. So the state and local and federal governments are subsidizing the largest source of foreign exchange going into Central America and Mexico. So I would put a 15% tax on every dollar sent to Latin America or Mexico. And with that, you would probably get somewhere around $8 or $9 billion a year. And see how that works first, and then see if the problem then continues. I think I would cut off all federal funds, not just talk about law enforcement aids, but any jurisdiction that says federal laws about immigration and those convicted of crimes who are here illegally don't apply in San Francisco County or in LA, downtown LA. If they want to do that, that's fine, but then they shouldn't expect federal funds. Or you could say to them, if you want to go that route, then maybe people in Utah and New Mexico or Arizona or Texas or Wyoming shouldn't have to follow federal gun laws or EPA endangered species lists. Just
exactly.
Let these local communities. And I think that would stop it pretty quickly.
I've been asked many times, if you were to talk to Donald Trump, what's the single most important piece of advice you give him? And I always say it's one word, ignore, just ignore. Democrats should do it. And all this talk and so forth, and in fact, he makes himself look bad with statements like that he's going to build a wall, Mexico's going to pay for it. I just think you've got the levers of power. You've got everything on your side. Just ignore them and do it, as you said. I couldn't agree more. Now, let me switch to another topic, because in reading your book, it was just almost a relief to me to see somebody finally speak up. One of the things that most annoys me about the Russia collusion hoax is the lying and arrogance of John Brennan and the apparent lack of interest in thoroughly investigating his involvement in just about everything, but he pops up everywhere. And that's why I was so pleased that you zeroed in on him and said, among other things, that you believe he's the one who's guilty of colluding with a foreign power to overturn the 2016 election. So why don't you share with our listeners some of the conclusions you've drawn, that you wrote about in your book, about John Brennan's questionable activities, because I think he's the elephant in the room, and he's getting by right now with murder. We'll see what happens after Nunes turns his stuff over to the Justice
Department. He's a very interesting – remember, he ingratiated himself with George Bush, and he was one of the architects of what was then known as enhanced interrogation. And then he modified himself or transmogrified himself into a liberal when Obama came in to get him to continue his job. But almost immediately, he lied under oath twice. He told the U.S. Congress, the Senate in particular, that he had never ordered surveillance of Senate computers. He had. Then he made an astounding statement that not one person had ever been killed in a collateral accidental fashion by drone-targeted assassination in Afghanistan. He was forced to come back and apologize that he had lied under oath on both occasions. Then he made the statement that he had never had access to the dossier, I think he said until May of 2017, but we're pretty sure that during the election that he was emailing Harry Reid and trying to interest Harry Reid in taking the dossier and giving it to James Comey and to the FBI during the election. And so he lied about that. Then it's pretty clear that somebody was coordinating foreign intelligence agencies, specifically the British and the Australians, Alexander Downer, to help the FBI when they put an informant into the Trump campaign. In other words, the FBI was being aided by the CIA's contacts abroad, even though the CIA was forbidden by law to interfere in U.S. domestic surveillance. And so I guess what I'm saying is there's tripartite. There's John Brennan up to this activity had lied under oath and had never been called to account. I don't think the statute of limitations are over yet on those two lies that he swore under oath. And then there is the ability to use the CIA to enhance the Steele dossier's relevance and resonance. And he also inserted the dossier, apparently, in the daily intelligence briefings that Barack Obama would read. So Obama, or at least the salacious parts. And then third, there was a line about what he'd actually done. He's pretty much on record in his sworn testimonies that he had no access or firsthand knowledge of the dossier throughout the entire 2016 campaign, which we know is not true. And then during the transition from November of 16 to January of 2017, and then the early part of the Trump presidency. And I think that Nunes will be very careful, but he will bring documents for referral and testimonies with referral that cannot corroborate what Brennan said. And once you start leveraging Brennan and Clapper and McCabe and Comey and James Baker and Mabecki and Sally Yates and Susan Rice and Samantha Power, and you start to say, look, this testimony that you gave is in conflict with this testimony you gave and with person A, B, and C. Now, we're willing to cut a deal with you if you'll just tell us what happened. I think they will all break ranks.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, I feel that's what they needed for. I mean, you have Cheryl Mills and Uma Abedin and Samantha Powers said, what in the heck is a UN ambassador unmasking anyone for, let alone 260 people? I mean, it's crazy.
I don't know.
And then you got James Comey, and we know he's a weasel, and he admitted to committing felonies, in my opinion, when he talked about
what he did.
And got the memo. Yeah, he got the memo to his friend and all that, and he reminded me of the kind of guy that would turn state's evidence real quick if he was confronted.
I think he might have the most. I think he has actually the most exposure of any of them because he swore under oath to a FISA court that the evidence that he produced for a writ of surveillance was complete and verified. And we know now he didn't tell the court that it was paid for by Hillary Clinton unverified. And Christopher Steele had been fired from being unreliable. And then we know that he leaked 4 to 6 memos, and one of them was probably classified. And we know that, I guess it was 245 occasions he told the House Intelligence Committee, and I think it was the House Oversight Committee, that he couldn't remember or didn't know the answer.
Right.
I think he's
right.
Got a lot of things to – he's got a lot of things that he's going to have to answer for.
Well, I'd love to see the screws turned on his thumbs for sure. And while we're on this subject, a lot of people don't understand the FISA warrant scandal. And so could you please walk us through the whole process step by step and explain what was illegal about obtaining those warrants in the first place? And as a second part to that question, I've been suspicious of the FISA court judges from day one. And the fact we never heard from them is very suspicious. But go ahead and opine on all this.
Well, after 9/11, we recharged the law that allowed the U.S. government to spy not just on foreign terrorists without notifying them as residents of you know, their Miranda rights, but U.S. citizens that were either finagling or conspiring with foreigners or were swept up in surveillance of foreigners. But what happened apparently in October of 2016 is that Sally Yates, Obama's deputy attorney general, along with James Comey and probably Rod Rosenstein later, and Andrew McCabe then, that is during the campaign, remember, they asked to spy on Carter Page. They'd done it before, but they felt that if they spied on Carter Page, then everybody Carter Page talked to in the Trump campaign would come up and they could find information about it, and then that information would not be kept secret. Those surveillances, those transcripts could be dispersed among the Obama administration and people could unmask the names, which happened, and then leaked And so this isn't just idle speculation, because before the election took place in November, Michael Iskoff for Yahoo News and David Korn for Mother Jones, I think Julia Jaffe for Washington Post, they were printing articles, letters, essays saying that Donald Trump was compromised. There was salacious material about him in Moscow. The FBI was investigating him. This was all done, and it did hurt Trump. He went down 2 or 3 points in the polls, even lower. And so that was designed to do that. And then when he was elected during the transition and all the way up until, I think it was April of 2017, during his presence, on three more occasions, that his own deputy attorney general, who had stayed over from Obama, Rod Rosenstein, and others, McCabe and Comey, until they were fired, they renewed those FISA applications three times to spy on people that they felt were involved. Carter Page again, but everybody says Carter Page. They knew Carter Page was not compromised because they'd used him as an informant in the past, but they did know that he talked to a lot of people. And that was a way of reverse targeting people in the Trump campaign and then getting texts and then leaking it out. And what's disturbing about the FISA judges is they signed off on four occasions on a dossier as the prime source of evidence. But and the problem was is that the author of the dossier had been fired. They never asked that question. They were told that it was opposition resource, but they never asked, well, if it's opposition research, it had to be Hillary Clinton. They never asked and were never told that. They relied on evidence from Yahoo News and Mother Jones as independent sources of confirmation, but they were in circular fashion just drawing on the dossier itself, and they were never told that the author had just been fired by the FBI as an informant or, I don't know, contractor. And then we know from the Page Strzok corpus, those texts between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, they were intimate. They said that they knew one of the FISA judges, and they were going to see him at a party, and they were going to talk to him. And we don't know to what degree that was just an outlier or that these judges – I guess the question we have is, were these judges innocent dupes, and they were just so routine a process? It's pretty a serious thing to give a warrant to spy on an American citizen. But it seems incredible as we look at this entire scandal unfolding that a judge would be so naive not just to ask a question. When he gets information and says, wow, you're saying this is opposition research, but there was only two candidates in the election, so it has to be who? It's not Jill Stein. It's got to be Hillary Clinton. But they didn't even ask that question, or they were never told. We don't quite know because they were so heavily redacted, those applications, that they're almost meaningless. And one of the good things about the culmination of the Mueller investigation is now Trump's lawyers are not telling him you can't release that unredacted FISA application because it might seem like it was obstruction of justice or compromise this or that. I think he'll start releasing those documents. And it's not going to be pretty. I think it's going to show that somebody was either the judge or the DOJ or the FBI or all of them were deliberately trying to take an unfounded rumor rag and get it out to as many people in government as possible on the expectation they would leak and then first damage the Trump campaign, and after he got elected, go back at it again to damage his presidency, then go back at it again to hide what they did and say, if we just get so many people wrapped up with collusion, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice, they'll never have the time or the inclination or the knowledge to go back after us for what we did. So in some ways, it became a preemptive defense of their own illegal behavior.
Yeah, well, I'm suspicious for a lot of reasons. First of all, from day one, I wondered why they weren't in an uproar, like we've been deceived, and here we are a year and a half later, and still nothing. And the other thing is what you mentioned, I believe it was Strzok, who had texted something about didn't want to be seen as being too friendly with this one particular judge. And to me, Victor, the thing smells pretty bad. I'll tell you, I am putting a lot of hope in Bill Barr and Lindsey Graham. I if these guys roll their sleeves up and really do the right thing, yeah, I think the whole thing's going to come apart. All they have to do
I think
is what what people like you and I and really millions of other Americans already knew a year and a half ago. All they need to do is catch up.
I think that's the one thing that we're not talking about is when Mueller was appointed in May, all his information was available to him, and it was pretty clear, even though he'd stacked his 17-lawyer team inordinately with people who either, you know, had defended Clinton or had been briefed on the dossier or were donors to Clinton or had defended the Clinton Foundation or were just registered Democrats. There wasn't one registered Republican other than Mueller himself. But the point I'm making is it's pretty clear that this was a partisan effort, but within 2 or 3 months, they knew that dossier was bogus and there was no validity to it, and yet they kept up for, you know, 18, 19 months. They went and down every cul-de-sac, every dead end, Flynn, Papadopoulos, Rick Gates, Cohen, and the point was to get as much dirt and throw it out there and hurt the Trump presidency as possible. It finally had, within 60 days, Mueller must have known this had nothing to do with the mandate which he was charged with. Find out if Donald Trump made a deal with the Russians so that he would be elected, and then when he, once he was president, he would give them concessions. And everybody knew that that was had not happened. Mueller knew it, but yet he kept on. And that, I think that's what we really have to ask. Why did he keep on doing it?
Exactly.
Month after month.
It puts a spotlight right on him. And the question is he ever going to be pulled into it? Because just based on what you said, all of which is true, it's fact. Why was he continuing on unless he was part of the whole conspiracy? It's a good question. Let me switch to something else real quick, because another thing you did really a great job of is talking about the Electoral College, and you made the comment that it balances out the popular vote. Now, I don't want to preempt you, but I wrote several articles about this, and I just wonder how many people, I don't think many, realize that if you take California out of the mix, and humorously, many Californians want to secede from the union anyway, and if you take them out of the mix, instead of Hillary winning the election by 4.3 million votes or whatever it was, if you don't have California there, the whole rest of the country, including Illinois, New York, the New England states, Oregon, Washington State, and so forth, I don't think many people realize Trump actually would have won the popular votes in the other 49 states combined by 1.5 million votes. And the fact that California by itself made the difference, to me, of and by itself, that explains so well why the Electoral College is so important and what the Founding Fathers had in mind. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. You remember that in July and August, there were a few pundits that were worried that Donald Trump, based on their math, might win the popular vote, and then he would lose the Electoral College because they weren't sure people in California would come out to vote because they knew their vote wouldn't matter. And they thought people might not come out in Illinois and New York because they knew that their vote probably wouldn't matter. The state was going to go blue anyway. And she was going to win that Electoral College. And they thought, wow, there's no way he's going to flip Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin or Iowa that he has to. So they were worried that Donald Trump wouldn't accept the results. He would be so angry that he won the popular vote. But they were praising the Electoral College. But the founders, and then when it was revised in the early 19th century, the arguments they used were there were certain value in people who were not in cities, that throughout history, people who lived in dense urban environments needed to be balanced by more practical people in rural areas. And if you didn't have an electoral college, the election would only be decided or campaigned in or discussed in the cities of the East Coast and later the Midwest and here. And then the second thing is they did not want a European fragmentation of the vote. In other words, without an electoral college, you're going to get 20 people running as you do in a primary. but even more so, it's going to be just directly popular vote. But one of the reasons that people don't run for president is the third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth, and tenth candidate is they know they're not going to pick up one state. In other words, it's very, not since George Wallace, Ross Perot. No, even Ross Perot, I don't think, picked up a state. It was George Wallace who was the last third-party person. So what it does is it keeps the vote, it makes it more likely that the person who is going to be elected president has between 45 and above percent of the popular vote. And we're not going to get a president with 15 candidates who got, 21% of the vote, because with an electoral college, you just have to win the vote within a state, and you've got to get a majority of those state electoral votes. And it really has worked. So we never really have more than three candidates that are serious, and mostly just two.
Let's jump to the Democrats' agenda, which is would have been ridiculous even 10, certainly 20 years ago. Reparations, infanticide, open borders, everybody knows the list by now.
Yeah.
And I have to wonder, when push comes to shove, how many independents or even center-left Democrats will actually pull the lever for this kind of nonsense? And I'd really like to hear your thoughts on this, because it's so important right now. I'm trying to figure this whole thing out. And with Howard Schultz looking like he's going to join the fray, it raises some interesting questions about how this is all going to come out. What are your thoughts about people actually pulling the lever for this crazy agenda?
Yeah, I think it depends on how potent these agendas are by the time we get to the actual debates, because there will be somebody, whether Joe Biden still survives or we get a Michael Bloomberg comes back, but there'll be somebody who decides that since most of them support this agenda, they feel there's an opening not to support it. But
right.
Will they be able to survive a campaign, a debate, a convention? I don't think so. I think one of the requirements, as we saw with Al Sharpton, that had these people lining up to kiss his ring, that they feel that they can't win a primary because of this crazy base without compromising themselves or staining themselves in a way that's going to come back and haunt them. And what I don't think they realize that a president doesn't do well in a second term, or he does not get reelected. Only about three different, usually they get reelected, but only if the economy collapses, as happened to Jimmy Carter and some ways to George H.W. Bush, at least that's what Clinton said, or he's in a non-popular war, like the LBJ in Vietnam, or Bush's second term was kind of overshadowed by Iraq, or there's a scandal like Watergate. I don't see any of these three things happening in the next, I just don't see them happening in the next 18 months. On the other hand, I look at the analytics for, say, Obama and Bill Clinton. At this time in their presidency, they were polling right about where Donald Trump is, and in 43 to 45 at the beginning of the third year. They didn't do as well in the Senate. They lost respectively 8 and 6 seats. He picked up 2. He lost 39 House seats. They lost respectively, I think it was 53 and 62. So by all of these analytics, Trump is doing pretty well, at least, and I don't mention George W. Bush, who got reelected. He had better statistics in both all those categories than either did Clinton or Obama, and they won handily. They beat Bob Dole and they beat Mitt Romney pretty easily. So I think it's Trump's election to lose, and then he's not going to be running in a vacuum. It's not a popularity contest. It's between a good candidate or a better one, or a bad one and a worse one. And whoever emerges from this crazy field is likely going to be less attractive than Hillary Clinton was. And so, and Trump
Very
is not
possible.
A novice
possible.
Now. He's got a record to run on. It's not 2016 when people in the center and right said, I don't believe he's really conservative, or I think he's crazy, or he's an actor. He's actually governed now. And it's not that, it's a pretty good record. So unless something, he melts down or he gets ill or there's a scandal or a war or a recession, I don't see him losing.
Right. And I think his people are smart enough to know, and I've written about this a couple of times, just focus on Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Florida. I mean, he ought to be visiting those states over and over again. He wins those four states again. He can even, and I did a whole breakdown on the electoral votes, but if he can afford to lose Wisconsin and maybe even one or two other smaller states, and I think if he focuses on those states, and they're all smart enough to know that, it's no way they're going to beat him. I do believe that.
I think that I'm living in an area that's 90% Mexican-American, the San Joaquin Valley, and I've noticed that, although it doesn't matter in California, his support among Hispanics is going way up because you can just see the activity, even in California around here. People are being hired everywhere. The Hispanic unemployment rate is record lows, and people are not, in these communities, are not necessarily in favor of illegal immigration. It impacts your school. Where I'm speaking to you today, there were three accidents in the last 10 days where an illegal alien broke a traffic law and collided with a trucker and a car with a pregnant woman in it and killed them. And all of the victims were Mexican-American. And their schools are impacted with non-English speakers. Their children are bullied by Norteños and Sereno gang members. And I think it's very possible that he could get 40 to 45% of the Hispanic vote. It wouldn't help in California, but it might flip a state like Colorado or Nevada or even New Mexico. And I think,
or even Virginia. Even Virginia.
Or
with
even
what's
in
going
Virginia.
On there,
but, yeah, Virginia or North Carolina even. So I think that he has a record for African Americans and Hispanics that he should really be emphasizing. He's done a lot for those communities, and I don't know why he doesn't remind people more of it, because he doesn't have to get a majority. It's just that the Democratic Party is so leveraged by identity politics and is so alienated the white working classes, they can't afford to lose 40% of the Hispanic vote or 20% of the African-American vote. The math just doesn't
Agreed.
Work for them if they do.
Agreed. Two final questions, Victor. In your book, you talk about the creation of new freedoms, such as free health care and a free college education, and that, and I'm quoting you, in the end, ruin is the natural condition of the nation state. Why don't you explain exactly what you mean by that statement, and also tell us if you think there's a practical way to stop the ruin that you refer to.
Well, when you look at this 5th century Greek city-state or Rome or the Byzantine Empire or the Spanish Empire, you don't really see that there's barbarians just pop up out of nowhere. Usually the concrete threats have been dealt with pretty well in the past. But what happens is that people, as the standard of living increases, their expectations, their appetites increase geometrically. But the income increases arithmetically. So these countries either inflate their currencies or they expand their social programs. And there's an expectation, an entitlement mentality that takes over. So they lose the original ingredients that made the Roman Republic very dynamic, or the Athenian agrarian, the most effective hoplite citizen in the Greek world, or the Byzantine Empire, the most efficient and effective in the Eastern Mediterranean. And you can see that in our own society, where whatever entitlement we have, whether it's Social Security or Medicare or Medi-Cal or here or Medicaid or Section 8 housing or so-called food stamps, there's never any evidence that I can think of that it retracts. In other words, it always expands, because there's always somebody who says, it's not fair. I don't have what that person has. And the government has a duty to make sure that we have a quality result. Once you get rid of the idea of a quality of opportunity and you institutionalize mandated quality of result, you go down the path of the French Revolution, and it ends the chaos. And whether that stops or not depends on a number of people standing up and saying, you know what, life is pretty good in 21st century America. And given technology, cell phones, television, air conditioning, all the people who are complaining that they have to have this and that, on the government have it pretty good, at least far better than their grandparents or great-grandparents. So it's time to take a reality check and start balancing the budget, cutting back on entitlements. And if you don't do that, we know what's going to happen. The currency is going to be worthless. The brand of the United States government is going to be worthless. And the budget's going to be consumed by interest on the national debt. And yet, even to say that in this climate means, oh, you want to put people in cages on the border, or you want to put the homeless on the streets of San Francisco. And so I guess what I'm saying is, when a society, I get to quote Libby, said societies fail when the remedy or the necessary medicine is considered worse than the original disease. And that's where we are now, that the effort to rectify what's going wrong would be considered so much worse than just sliding into a comfortable decline, that we're paralyzed. And that's why another reason Trump came in. People said, we're paralyzed. We have no answers. We don't know what about, you know, we can't build Keystone. Anwar will never open up. You can't deregulate that. The EPA is out of control. You have to compromise on judges. China is going to take over the world. The border will never be closed. And his appeal was, he said, make America great. We don't have to. We can stand the remedy. We can take the medicine. But whether he succeeds or fails, I'm not sure. That's a 50-50 question,
yeah, Mike,
I think.
My concern, I wrote a whole book about this once. It's, to me, it's a deflationary depression versus runaway inflation. And because of the avariciousness of most human beings, it's hard for me, always been hard for me to picture anything short of a runaway inflation, because at some point people just don't want to give anything up. Now, it would take a lot of education, but we won't go into that any further because that's a big subject. But I'll just give this one final question, Victor, and this is a simple one, but it's a big one. With all the hatred between the radical left and conservatives, are you at all concerned about the possibility of a real, live, violent revolution in America?
Well, we've had that before, as you know, in the Civil War. We've come close maybe in the 60s in the Nullification Crisis, 1820. So we know how to avoid it by not making the same mistakes. But I think everybody's got to cool the rhetoric, and by that I mean we've got to start. A lot of it is not class anymore; it's race and gender, and we've got to just say, take a deep breath and say, "I, Victor Hansen, am not a white person. I'm an American. I don't see myself as white. If you're black, or you're brown, or you're Asian, you've got to take a step back and say, you know, nobody's ever tried the multiracial society before." And we know the melting pot works. It's not perfect, but we're constantly improving. And so once you go down that road of identifying by your race or your tribe or your nationality or ethnicity or your gender and separating yourself off, that's an open invitation for other people to do the same thing to survive. And we're going to be like the Balkans or Rwanda or Iraq. I think that's the great challenge now, but yet these people want to have open borders, and they want to have hyphenated names, and they gin this up. And then they get mad. They do something. Maybe you have an answer, but if I were a minority activist like Al Sharpton or Kamala Harris or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and I was, by my own estimation, a minority of 30% of the country, first of all, I wouldn't assume that all 30% walk in solidarity. They don't. But if I did assume that, I would not insult, attack, disparage 70% of the majority. It doesn't make any sense to say day after day after day, white privilege, white privilege, white privilege, white privilege. And it doesn't make any sense. Or then to have all of these candidates like Bernie and Beto and Biden every day apologize for being white, apologize for being male, apologize. It's going to create a backlash. That's what worries me. because ultimately some people are going to say, you know what, I never thought of myself as a majority white person. My children are intermarried. I don't care about how people, but if they're going to target me and say I'm responsible for everything from the Civil War to racism, sexism, and they identify me by my skin color, then maybe I should do the same. And once that starts, that's not going to be pretty.
Yeah, then you're opening the door to Nazism. Then, so
yeah, I don't think. Yeah, we don't want that to happen. So I think if you see the Democratic Party, they've got a real existential paradox because they have said this is the party. If you look at that crazy Abrams candidate in Georgia, Stacey Abrams,
yeah,
she said that she's in identity politics, and you really don't want a white male, but yet. It's the three top leaders so far in the polls are not Kamala Harris, or not Julian Castro, they're not Elizabeth Warren, they're not Cory Booker. They're three white guys, three white males. And that's not supposed to happen according to the new philosophy of the Democratic Party. And so their whole ideology is not stable. It's so self-contradictory and so volatile that it's going to provoke a reaction if they don't watch it. And that's what I'm worried about. That I talk to people all over the country when I speak. I don't think that Al Sharpton or Elizabeth Warren or Cory Booker, or when they start down that line, you have privilege, privilege, privilege. And they're talking to a welder in Bakersfield or a machinist in Southern Ohio or a carpenter in Alabama who has no white privilege at all. And these people live in very nice places, and they have good jobs, or Barbra Streisand in Malibu, or Hollywood actor in the Hombe Hill. When they start calling people who have no privilege at all privileged, whether they're virtue signaling or they're projecting, I don't know the cause, but that is a very volatile thing to do. And they should not do it.
I agree. Yeah, I agree totally. And I think the bottom line is that when you deal in lies, and that's the tools of the trade for the radical left, it's just almost automatically the way nature works. It's going to come back and bite you. It's a boomerang. And
yeah,
the one thing they got going for them is they're never embarrassed, Victor. They're never embarrassed, and they just keep going. But they look worse and worse and worse. And I think they, way before the election, maybe in the next 3 to 6 months, they're going to start seeing some dramatic and scary things in the polls that tell them this ain't working for you. And then it's going to be interesting to see what the so-called establishment Democrats like Nancy Pelosi, who herself is a little crazy, but she understands money and power. It's going to be interesting to see what they do, because she already told them to calm down about so many things. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. Well, look, Victor, I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us today. They were all great. I loved everything that you said, and you've given us a lot of things to think about, and I hope you come back and visit with us again real soon.
Thank you for having me.